This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you are one of the roughly 43 million Americans with student loan debt, you didn't have a payment due today. And you haven't had one in a while. That's because last month, President Biden extended the student loan payment moratorium again, this time until August 31st. Those with student loans have been without payments since March 2020, but their average debt, according to Forbes, is almost $29,000. And since this pause isn't forever, at least for now, they'll soon be paying it again. Unless someone does something, and Williams College is. It is turning all of its financial aid into grants, no loans, and students will no longer have to hold a job to qualify. The change starts with next fall's class, and Liz Creighton, Dean of Admissions and Student Financial Services at Williams College in Williamstown, joins us to talk about it. Liz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Liz, you're the first institution in the country to do the whole package, all grants and no work requirements. So how does this work for students?
Yeah, so as you said, effective this coming fall of 2022, we will offer a financial aid program that provides every bit of financial aid in the form of grants that don't need to be paid back. So students won't have to take out loans. They won't have to have a work study job on campus during the year. And they also won't be expected to work in the summer and contribute from what they've earned during those summer jobs back to the cost of college. So we're investing about $6 million new dollars into our financial aid budget in order to make this possible for all of our students who receive financial aid.
So why now, Liz? And can you kind of scope out for us, what does this mean financially for your average student? What do these numbers look like?
Sure. Yeah. So first, your question of why now, you know, Williams has for a long time been focused as one of our sort of primary values as an institution on making Williams accessible to students from a wide range of backgrounds and then making sure it's affordable for them once they get in. But more recently, we've been focused on this idea that we're calling true affordability, which is not just about making it possible for students to come here, but once they're here, making sure that every student, no matter their family's resources, can avail themselves of all of the opportunities that exist at a place like this. So internships and research opportunities and the chance to study abroad. And so we've really been working on building out our financial aid program to address the things that many colleges think about, like tuition and room and board, but also some of the hidden costs that can oftentimes trip families up.
Like what? What's a hidden cost that can trip
sure.
a family up?
You know, one of the first ones that comes to mind is the cost of textbooks. You know, students get to college, all of a sudden they have this opportunity to take courses, you know, across, in the case of Williams, 65 different academic departments. And we want to make sure that students aren't selecting the courses that they take based on how much textbooks will cost. And so we cover the full cost of textbooks for all financial aid students.
And to put it in perspective, Liz, my understanding is tuition, room, board fees, just under $79,000 per year for a Williams student. Is that right?
That's right.
So one of the interesting things about this, I understand that there are some other universities who have worked in this area of changing loans to grants, but this work requirement thing, which you explained a minute ago, is different. I understand it must make sense to do that in terms of giving students the opportunity to have the full college experience. But what about students who have to work to pay their way through who aren't receiving these grants, or the idea that working in college is part of preparing for adulthood after college?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree with all of those things. And, you know, just to give you a sense at Williams, historically, about 75% of students work on campus, and that's true across all of our students. So both students who receive financial aid, as well as other students who aren't on financial aid. And so we agree that work is a really important part of the college experience. It's a great extension of things that students are learning in the classroom. It provides really good preparation for life after college. And so we have every expectation that many students will continue working, even though we won't require them to. The difference now is that they get to choose the work dynamic that makes the most sense for them. So they can choose how much they work, and perhaps more importantly, they can choose what they do with that money. So we know that many students work and send money back to their families to help offset costs at home. Many of them take some of what they earn to help their parents for the parent portion of what they've been asked to pay for college. So we have every expectation that students will continue to be engaged in the community and lots of different work experiences. But we have just been really focused on giving them the opportunity to find a work dynamic that supports all the goals they have for college.
So Liz, in preparing for this conversation, we reached out to our listener base, and Praveen in Brookline is part of our Radio Boston texting group. We asked him, our listeners, about their experiences. He said, quote, "I went to medical school over 20 years ago, and I'm still paying off my loans. $250,000 was the starting point, and I'm down to $80,000. Now, Praveen told us more than that, but I imagine somebody who's looking at a debt profile like that, and obviously medical school is beyond just undergraduate, would feel tremendous relief. So what are you hearing from your students? And what about the students who didn't get this so far? What are you hearing from them too?
Yeah, the announcement has been met with just broad enthusiasm and excitement, both for the students who will still be here next year and will benefit from it, but even from our current seniors who are graduating, who I think just are taking a lot of pride in the fact that Williams is the first institution to do this. And, you know, we've been in a fortunate position here. Typically about 30% of Williams graduates took out loans at some point during their 4 years. And you mentioned at the start that the national average right now is right around $30,000 for debt at graduation. The average among Williams students in the past has been about $12,000. So we've always taken a lot of pride in keeping the average indebtedness for our students quite low. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we've been focused on other things, as I said, like the cost of textbooks in our financial aid program. But, you know, I think certainly this gives the students will benefit from this over in the future at Williams. And then prospective students who are thinking about college, the flexibility to imagine a different kind of college experience, in which loan debt and the burden of having to work are not part of the equation. And so we're really excited about that and about the amazing students it'll bring to Williams as a result.
Yeah, it's not hard to imagine that this makes you more competitive. Just before I let you go, just in a sentence, how do you keep this up? How do you sustain this? Things get more expensive every year.
They do. You know, we're in the position to be able to do this because of truly generations of remarkable support from alumni at Williams. And that is a sort of core part of the Williams experience. And we're confident that will remain the case going forward. And also because of really careful stewardship of our endowment over many years. So, we have taken good care of the generous resources we've been able to collect over the years. And we're excited about the ability to put those into use for our students.
All right. Liz Creighton is Dean of Admissions and Student Financial Services at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we'd like you to join our texting group, just like Praveen in Brookline did, so you can tell us your stories. To get started, text the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382. That's BOSTON to 617-766-0382. So with us in studio now, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Welcome back, Max.
Thanks for having me back.
So first, just reactions to what you just heard.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like good news, certainly, for the people who'll graduate from Williams in the year ahead. And it does also feel like not a death rattle, but a sort of sign of alarm about the institution of the student loan, I think. There's just, because of those high numbers, $79,000, it does raise a question of how long we can go on like this.
And I mean, the price tag there, $6 million for them to do this coming year. And we know tuition goes up. So is this replicable by larger colleges and universities even? Are others going to do that? Or are there challenges that Williams doesn't have that others will?
There are certainly challenges that other places would have. There are kind of diverse number of species in the higher ed ecosystem, right? And Williams is one of these apex kind of elite wealthy schools. They've got more than $1 million set aside for each of the undergraduates that are on campus at any given time. There are only a few others who can say the same. It's Harvard, it's MIT, it's Amherst College. And those schools can afford to do something on this pattern, and many have or are continuing to do so. But then most institutions fall outside of that group, sometimes by a long, long distance. And for them, it'd be harder. You know, at Williams, she mentioned the median student debt burden is around 11,000. At even kind of big, venerable schools, Holy Cross, Brandeis, BU, it's more than twice as large. And meanwhile, they have a research arm that they have to service and usually, you know, all the complexities that come with being a university. So it gets that much harder the bigger you get.
So you mentioned Harvard, Amherst. What are they doing and who else is trying to crack this nut in Massachusetts?
I think Harvard should get some credit for kind of trying to kick off this wave. They had the Harvard Financial Aid Initiative, which is 15, 16, 17 years old now. That was the announcement in 2004 under then-President Larry Summers, who, you know, that any family that earned less than $65,000, their students could come to Harvard for free. And under $85,000, I think, students didn't have to pay very much. Ever since, they've been sort of raising that income threshold, Tiziana. So there are more and more families that don't have to pay to attend. But they do still give out loans. And you have wealthy students who are paying full freight. And then just back in October, Amherst College, which is sort of Williams' closest competitor, I would think, their analog in the state, they made attending tuition free for people from the lowest income 80% of American households. So that was a $71 million investment.
That's
so that's yeah, that was big news too. But you know, Tiziana, it can feel like this game of sort of generosity poker that only these, you know, sort of whales, big wealthy schools can play, and here Williams is throwing their chips in.
Right. So to that point, I was thinking about this as I was reading the story. We did a lot of coverage. You were on our air about it earlier in the pandemic and before, as we saw a number of small liberal arts colleges, smaller institutions, go out of business. And now we see a small institution taking these kinds of big financial steps. How do we square that circle?
Well, I use that species word advisedly. It's an ecosystem, and it can feel like Darwinian at times. So you think about places like Amherst and Williams. They have a ton of appeal already. Beautiful campuses, small classes, and you know, graduates can expect to earn on average $80,000 or $90,000 a year 10 years after they graduate. And now there's the fact that it's going to be even cheaper, if not free, to attend. It's just another draw. But then again, it's a 1 in 10 chance of getting into those schools. At another school that isn't as selective and isn't as wealthy, you know, there's a balancing act where you want to try to keep up with these really prestigious, really affordable schools. You know, you may be excellent, but you just aren't in this kind of ideal situation to make these kind of trade-offs. And I think that, you know, you remember Mount Ida closing now 3 or 4
yes.
years ago. Even a small drop-off in the number of enrollees that you get in the fall can mean like a fatal financial blow.
So speaking of drop-offs, the other thing reported, you know, early in the pandemic were fewer applications for student loans. So what are we seeing now? Is that continuing or what's the trend lately?
Yeah, you had the numbers fell off a cliff a year and two ago. 7% decline February 2020 to February 2021. And that doesn't mean just that people aren't borrowing. It means largely that they've deferred college or sort of not doing it in the middle of the pandemic. Now, it's down again this February. It's down by 2%, though, you know, more of a dip than a plunge. So it does feel, though, like an enrollment officer's kind of worst nightmare. We're long time worried about the graying, aging population of this state, dwindling number of young people ready to go to college. And then the financial situation for many families is so uncertain that they might still be forestalling this and maybe unlikely to come back.
All right. So President Biden extended this moratorium until August. He's under tremendous pressure, including inside his own party, to do something more permanent to forgive student loan debt. What are you watching over these next couple months?
Well, I mean, it feels like he almost has to forgive $10,000 worth of student debt. It was a campaign trail promise. And it would be a victory for, as you said, Tiziana, you know, Massachusetts legislators like Ayanna Pressley and Elizabeth Warren, who've been pushing hard for that. With that said, people have pointed out repeatedly that that would mean attacking a symptom and not the cause, namely the high and fast rising cost of college. So schools may try to follow Williams, Amherst, and Harvard and try to cut or limit the cost of attending. And that would, you know, negate, if not, you know, or minimize the debt burden that they create. But as we've said, you know, if they don't do that, it'll just start to metastasize again. And trying to follow Williams Amherst here would mean financial risk for schools that just don't have the means to do that.
Well, we will watch alongside you, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin. Max, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden is announcing a new approach to enforcement today, specifically targeting those arrested in and around the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnea Cass Boulevard, or Mass and Cass in Boston. Anyone arrested there for crimes that may have a root in mental illness or substance use may have the option to receive treatment instead of going to court and facing a possible jail sentence. This news comes in the wake of the temporary closure of Boston's engagement center in that area after 5 stabbings were reported around the center last week. We get the latest on all of that from WBOR's Deborah Becker in the first of a new weekly conversation that we'll be having on the show called From the Newsroom. Our intent there is to kind of dive into some of the work happening in and from our reporters, not only what's happening now, but how it fits into how they think about the stories and beats that they cover. Deb, it is really fun to have you for the first of these. Thanks for coming back and joining us here on Radio Boston.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, so I do want to start in a very serious place here. You covered the closure of the Boston Engagement Center last week after these 5 stabbings. What is the latest on that front? Have they reopened? When will they reopen? What do we expect?
The engagement center is scheduled to reopen tomorrow. It was closed for 5 days. City officials are still talking about what measures might be in place tomorrow. The center was already operating with a reduced limit on the number of people allowed inside. It's likely that that will be capped to about 80 people when it reopens. But there are a lot of discussions going on at the moment in terms of how to ensure safety at the center when it reopens.
So my understanding is that the center's been servicing about 300 people a day. It's been pretty important for those seeking services after the city removed tents from the streets in January. Of course, you were there when some of those tents were removed. We talked with you live at the time. So talk more about the role that the center has been playing in the area since then.
Well, the center opened officially in a brick and mortar building. It was basically under a large tent near the homeless shelter on Atkinson and Southampton Street. So it opened in a brick and mortar building in December in a new building. It provides a variety of services aside from a place to get warm. It offers bathrooms, showers, laundry, meals. There's a doctor on site with Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless program. The doctor helps with wound care and other medical issues. The center provides referrals to addiction and mental health treatment. It helps people look into getting some sort of either temporary housing or moving toward permanent housing. And it has also referrals to other social services. And since it closed 5 days ago almost now, outreach workers have been trying to provide some of these services on the streets to the people who are in the area. But I'm told that there has been a dramatic reduction in the ability of people to get services, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, with the list of the various supports that you just talked about, I don't know how you, I mean, it's not like you just go somewhere else and there's a one-stop place to get those things. Now we have this news today from Suffolk County DA Kevin Hayden. You know, we talked about it at the top there, this approach to services instead of prosecution in certain cases. What do you make of the approach? It's called services over sentences.
Yeah. Well, it's an approach that's already being used, right? To some degree. Hayden's committing $400,000 from his office's asset forfeiture fund, and that's money from the seizure of illegal drugs. And the money would be specifically for programming for those charged or accused of crimes in the Mass and Cass area. The money would pay for the first year of the program. It would be used for a program coordinator, 2 recovery coaches, a clinician, and office equipment, according to DA Hayden. The program's run with the North Suffolk Mental Health Association. And the way it would work is that only those accused of nonviolent crimes would be eligible, and it would be up to prosecutors to determine who might be able to participate. If someone is deemed eligible, they would go to treatment and they could possibly have charges dismissed, so no incarceration, no criminal record. If this happens post-arraignment and someone is considered for this services over sentences program, participation in the program might mitigate a sentence.
And I got the sense in the little bit that I learned about this, Deb, in preparing for today, that Hayden finds it satisfying that you might use asset forfeiture money in order to do something like this.
Right. His press release did say that this is, this is an appropriate use of this money. It's money from the seizure of illegal drugs, and it should be used. And this, geographic area needs help, and there should be targeted funding to help in that area.
So, Deb, you mentioned that prosecutors will be the ones to determine who could opt to participate in the program. Are there concerns? Could it be murky to figure out which crimes are rooted, I don't love that word, but rooted in mental illness or substance use? Who can, should, and will qualify here?
Right. Of course, it's a tough determination because, so many crimes are rooted in mental illness and drug use. Most of the violence that prompted the closing of the Engagement Center and of Atkinson Street last week was because of fights over drug money. But this is an approach that law enforcement and the courts are increasingly using because they found that they're just arresting people over and over again for minor crimes. And then if you don't provide services, this is just an expensive cycle, really.
So, Deb, you've covered this a lot. What are you hearing from folks in terms of the city's latest actions? What's been happening over the last couple of weeks? What are you hearing?
Several advocates I spoke with are concerned. They've been asking the city to use a public health approach to the Mass and Cass area. City officials have said they are committed to doing that. I spoke with an advocate last week, and he accused city officials of punishing people in need of services based on the actions of a few because the Engagement Center and its services were closed off. On the other hand, there does appear to be more violence in that area. I'm told that dozens of people were crowded on the nearby streets there just this morning. Two tents were taken down this morning. And we should point out that Mayor Wu removed the last of the large tent encampment there in January and promised to provide housing. Dozens of people were placed in housing or shelters. So I think it's a wait and see at this point. That was January. The concern now is what's going to happen when the weather gets warmer.
And I guess I wonder, both with the stabbings, with the response from the city, I'm sure there were lots of predictions of positive and negative outcomes after the city took their steps. You've been watching this closely. Do you see the violence of last week as an aberration? And do the things that are unfolding echo any predictions from any of the players in this mix over the last few months?
Well, I think it's something that folks have always been concerned about. What I've heard from people who frequent the area is that there is increased gang presence there because of drugs. Mm. It is still an open-air drug market, essentially. The Boston Public Health Commission has hired an outside security firm to patrol the area around the Engagement Center, but there's still a significant amount of drug activity. This area, the Mass and Cass area, is still home to many social service programs that are concentrated in just a few blocks. So you have business leaders and others saying other communities should be incentivized to provide some of these services. So they're spread out. They're not all in this one neighborhood of Boston. Some business leaders have asked the state to step in, and they've suggested punishing communities if they don't offer services to their residents. So there is more of a regional approach to addiction and mental health.
Deb, this is our From the Newsroom. We get a chance to help our listeners hear what it's like for our reporters to cover their beats. This has been a very tough few years in that area with homelessness and addiction. What's it been like for you to cover all of this?
I think I would say there's so much sadness, right? There are so many people affected by addiction and mental health issues, especially when the tent encampment had grown to include hundreds and hundreds of people, and they were people from all over. It was a really diverse group of people, all ages, races, socioeconomic backgrounds. And so, you know, it was folks struggling with addiction, mental illness, folks who had criminal records and had difficulty finding a job that would pay the bills. I remember one conversation really sticks with me. Tiziana, I ran into this young man. His name was Chris, and I knew that his family was looking for him because I follow families on Facebook who are looking for loved ones in the Mass and Cass area, because many are. You know, when the tents were proliferating, folks were saying, do you know if my family member's down there? Are they safe? And I spoke with Chris, and he just became so emotional, and he said, you know, I'm not immoral. I'm not doing anything wrong. I've just relegated myself to being opioid dependent for the rest of my life. And I'm just constantly diffusing a bomb so I don't get sick. And he was very sad about that. And he said, you know, this is my life and I've accepted that. And this is how I'm going to live and I want to. And it was just tragic because you could tell it wasn't something he wanted either.
Wow. Deb, thank you for sharing that story. One thing you're going to watch in the next couple months?
I think I'll watch how the engagement center is monitored. They're talking about possibly putting metal detectors in and what kind of security might be provided there. And other, you know, obviously, as we said, once the weather gets warmer, it's likely that people will return to that area and find a way to stay.
Deb Becker, WBUR reporter, thank you so much for joining us from the newsroom.
You're welcome.
We're going to the theater and a play called Black Superhero Magic Mama by Inda Craig Galvan. Every word in the title of that play counts in understanding what it's about. A black mother whose teenage son is killed by a police officer and turns to the magic of being a comic book superhero in order to cope with the grind of her grief and a drumbeat of exploitation by the media and expectations of her from a grieving community. Now, I'm not giving anything away by telling you that her son Tremarian dies. It's the basis for the play, as is the comic book superhero he and his friend Flat Joe have created. Here is Tremarian and Flat Joe, played by Joshua Robinson and Anderson Stinson III, debating the praiseworthiness of superheroes who don't have magical powers, like flying, versus those who do.
If you're that powerful and you choose to help people instead of run away, that's admirable. You don't abandon people. You don't leave. You use your powers to help all of
the stupid people.
I was going to say people. I don't even know what I'm talking about no more. Finish your list. I got to get out of here before your mom starts shading me just for being here.
Hey, I'm sorry about that, man.
Low key, I think she liked me.
She don't like you.
Nah, she only likes her baby. Man, your mom loses her mind if something ever happened to you. But hey, stick with me. I'll protect you.
And of course, in this work by Inda Craig Galvan, Sabrina does lose her mind, the mother, escaping into a world where she is the star of Tamarian's comic book. But through that, she finds her strength again. Monica White Ndunu is director of Black Superhero Magic Mama, a production of Company One with the American Repertory Theater, the Boston Public Library, and Boston Comics in Color Festival. She's also a professor of theater at Dartmouth College, joins us on the line now. Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So, having seen the play, it seems to me that there is nothing about it, Monica, that is not a profound and emotional undertaking. So, why did you want to do it?
Well, for several reasons. Number one, I'm a huge fan of Summer L. Williams, one of the co-founders of Company One. And when she reached out to me about the possibility of directing the play, and she sent me a copy of the script, and I read it, and normally, if I read something and if my gut doesn't tell me to do it, I don't do it, because I believe that we're all meant to tell stories, particular stories, or contribute to the telling of stories. And not everything that makes its way to me is something that I'm supposed to do, you know? So when I read this particular script, And it really resonated with me because I'm also a mother, and having experienced, you know, what it is to be a Black child in a society that devalues Black children, what it is to be a Black woman in a society that devalues Black people and women and being, you know, both, and being a mother, this just really resonated with me how there are certain expectations that Black women in particular are expected to live up to without the consideration of everything that we also have to contend with on a day-to-day basis.
There is so much reframing in this play, Monica, how we tell Black stories, how we tell stories about Black boys, how we tell superhero stories, how we tell women's stories, even how we produce on a stage. There are multimedia aspects to this. There's Black comic book figures brought forward. Everything seems like a reframe. And I felt in watching it, so many decisions you had to make about how to bring all the pieces of this story forward. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I would just, first of all, I'm really grateful to Enda for writing such a beautiful script. I think the foundation of the script that she wrote is really what guided me in the process. And also just a shout out to my dramaturgy team, Alana, Regine, and Africa, who did a brilliant job in terms of the research for this project. And, you know, just a lot of support generally in the creation of the piece. And all of the designers and technicians, it's really a collective effort. You know, generally the director will provide a vision based on the script and, you know, work with the actors to execute that, along with working with the designers and all of the folks who make up the team. And so for me, again, I was kind of guided by my gut impulse in terms of this is a story that I know I'm supposed to be a part of, and then just bringing my own sensibilities into it. One of the key elements of the vision that we talked about quite a lot throughout the process is the work of Dr. Linda James Myers, a Black psychologist, who she's basically outlined this concept, an Afrocentric cultural worldview or an optimal worldview, which she's used to describe the ways in which people of African descent and often indigenous communities around the world experience, you know, time and actually themselves and one another. And so within that worldview, it acknowledges that, you know, we don't experience time as linear and as it happens to be articulated in a Eurocentric framework, that for us, time is more cyclical, more like a spiral. And so, and for me, I often describe it as a moving spiral that can collapse in on itself and expand, which is why, you know, when people tell us that we should, you know, just get over slavery, well, one of the reasons we can't just get over slavery is because for us, it's still happening. We can still see how that same framework is operating in our day-to-day experiences. Additionally, Myers talks about an African concept of self. And in this concept of self, we don't see ourselves as individuals that are distinct from our ancestors or our families and communities, or even those who haven't been born yet. Within that concept of self, we're all of that. And so one of the ways I describe it is that when you see me walk into a room, entire nations are entering with me because I'm not just by myself. I'm connected to all of those, you know, whether you see them or not. So that's guided the vision of the overall project.
I want to pick up several threads there. And to do that, I'm going to give us a little more sound from the play. And this is Sabrina Jackson, played by Ramona Lisa Alexander, talking with her son, Tremarian, again, played by Joshua Robinson. And this is their this is hard stuff, folks. I want to make it clear that we're talking about grief and loss. But this is their last interaction together, the last time she sees him.
Oh, boy, come on, let's go.
You the one wanted to have the heart-to-heart.
Watch your mouth.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, no, honey, you can put that t-shirt on later. We don't have time for it now.
Ma, it's my lucky t-shirt. Every trophy I've won, I've always worn it.
Okay, I know, baby, but just put it in your bag. Maybe you could put it on when I drop you off with Coach Brackett. Let's go. Name the prime minister, name the Maasai warrior who was prime minister of Tanzania.
Edward Sokoine.
Ooh, that's my boy!
It is so hard to see the mundaneness of that, right? And realize it's her last moment. And then she goes on, in the end, the only way she can process is to become a Maasai warrior herself, one that her son and his friend had created in a comic book world of their own. So it is this moving between two worlds or many worlds and back and forth in time. We don't have a lot of time together left, but I think in the time I do, I want to talk about the challenges for somebody like Ramona Lisa Alexander in playing this role, and you as a mother in directing this and being present for this story over and over again. I mean, I have a teenage boy. I'm white. And it was a gut punch that stayed with me the rest of the day to watch it once.
Yes. I cannot speak for Ramona Lisa's experience. I can speak to the beauty and brilliance and grace that she brings to her portrayal of this mother's experience, because she's also a mother, as am I, as is Enda. And I think that's part of what has made it such an incredible journey in thinking about, actually, Regine had mentioned this image in one of Beyonce's videos that shows all of the mothers who have lost their sons, Trayvon Martin's mother, with Jordan Davis's mother, and Tamir Rice's mother, like all these mothers who are part of this sorority that none of us want to be a part of, that this sisterhood of having lost a son in this way. And I think the thing that gets me through is knowing that these are important. This is an important story to tell, to give voice to those who don't have this particular platform to use to share their story. But also because this play is crafted with its healing built into the play. And mm-hmm. So while we have to face, you know, the hazards of living while Black, you know, in the narrative itself, it also demonstrates pathways to healing and how much we need one another in order to do that.
And that is Monica White Ndunu, director of the play Black Superhero Magic Mama, which is currently showing at Boston Public Library's Central Library in Copley Square through May 21st. Thank you so much for joining us, Monica.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we turn now to two more people associated with the production. Alana Brownstein is the director of new work at Company One and co-dramaturg for the play, and Lydia Grafe, a teaching artist who works with the Boston Public Schools to bring the experience of and lessons from Black Superhero Magic Mama into the classroom. Ilana, Lydia, thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to, in our time, really focus on bringing this to the schools. I think you were key in selecting the play, figuring out how to put it on. Ilana, talk about the desire to expand the audience and expand the experience of this beyond, I don't want to say just the stage, because the stage is the central piece, but into education as well.
Absolutely. So when we program our seasons at Company One Theater, we are often thinking about not just what happens on the stage, but where the work and the themes of the work meet our communities, our multiple communities. And one of our core communities that we are intersecting with all the time is the Boston Public School System. We work with 9 different schools, placing teaching artists in those schools. And one of the goals of that program, which is called Stage One, is to train young people as civically engaged artists and artistically engaged citizens. And so though we don't choose our plays because we think they're perfect for high school students, for instance, we are really thoughtful about anything that we decide to produce. How is it going to be translated through our teaching artists and through our partnership to the students who are going to meet the play through any number of ways, whether that's student matinees, whether that's the ways that the teaching artists bring the material into the classroom, or whether that's through educator night outs, where we train educators who come to the shows how to bring the material back into their classrooms with curriculum guides and other kinds of support.
So flesh that out for us now, Lydia, as a teaching artist. How are you, and I know you've taught the play before, how are you thinking about both the material, what are you using to bring this into the classroom, and when does the classroom see the show, and how will that work?
I work at Boston Adult Technical Academy, and this is an alternative public school through BPS for 18 to 22-year-olds. And the majority of our students have either had interrupted education or recent immigrants, and the majority are English language learners. So currently we are working on a playwriting unit. And through stage one, my focus is in my classrooms is really building community and exploring identity and the importance and as Monica had mentioned, the healing that can happen through storytelling. And we are going to see the play. I'm taking the entire school, which is very exciting. And we're going to see it on Friday of this week, May 6th. And something that we're working on in our playwriting units is the idea of reframing, as you had mentioned, and that we sometimes are the story or the heroes of our own stories, and the importance of telling your own story, because someone might tell it for you, or someone has written a story about you or your community, and the importance of being able to tell your story yourself is, I think, a huge skill. The reason, and one of the biggest reasons we are taking students to see these shows is they get to have a theatrical experience, which they may have not had before, and also to see their stories their stories reflected on a stage. Yeah. and to know this is something that's also possible for a career, right? You can be a storyteller, and that might be through visual art, through acting, through directing, any sort of production. And so there's a lot of ways to tell a story, and
I'd like to pick that up there, Lydia, if you don't mind. Excuse me for interrupting, but you've said a couple of things that I want to bring back to Alana in terms of thinking about how to tell this story on the stage, mindful of the broad range of audiences who might see it. And there is visual art, and there is sound, and there is acting and directing. There's even breaking of the fourth wall, where the characters become themselves as actors again and talk to you about why the playwright wrote the play. So as you think about all of these pieces, what is your stewardship as a dramaturg, as the new projects director? I know that's not exactly technically the right title, but as, you know, the new projects director, to think about bringing something like this to the stage?
Yeah, it's this is core on how we operate. So Company One's mission is to create community at the intersection of art and social change. So we are never programming a play or producing a play just because we like the play, although we do like all the plays we produce.
One would hope.
We're really thinking about, like, is this a story that Boston needs right now? And how and why is that need going to be fulfilled by this play? And so when we decide to kind of bring the play to audiences and to communities who may or may not come see the play, right? So it's not just the audiences who we're speaking with. we are thinking a lot about how they might meet the material in the space itself. So one of the things we've been very careful about is, as you mentioned at the beginning of your chat with Monica, the material is really, really activating for a lot of people and for a lot of different reasons. It can cause our nervous systems to suddenly feel overwhelmed with all kinds of feelings. And so because we have a relationship with some community partners who specialize in trauma-informed care, we've been able to design not only a rehearsal and production process for our team, but also an audience care process that is trauma-informed. And that goes for everybody who comes, whether we're talking about the students who are going to come for the matinees, or we're talking about folks who wander in from the Boston Public Library because they see something happening and it's free, so it's accessible to them, or whether it's people who buy tickets in advance. You know, we've created a system within the lobby and within the space itself that is specifically designed to care for folks who might feel activated by the material and to then to be able to come back to it in a way that is healthy for them. So for us, like when we choose how to do our work, we're really thinking about not just the material and the themes and the stories, but also what is the experience of this like? We did a series of pop-up tours around Boston Public Library branches, bringing some of the themes to audiences, especially families and young children. So we didn't perform the play for them, but we brought materials and activities with the themes so folks could consider them. And we also brought healing arts with us too, because we know it's an activating content.
All right, that is Alana Brownstein. Alana is the director of new work at Company One and co-dramaturg on Black Superhero Magic Mama. And Lydia Graef, a teaching artist at Company One. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, that is our show. But before we go, we want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and share your stories by joining our texting club. We'll let you know what's coming up. We'll ask for your feedback. We'll ask you to give us input on future stories. We'll even give you chances to ask questions for things like Ask the Doctors. To get started, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Again, that's text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. We'd really like to have you as part of our texting community. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beland, and Sydney Bowles, with Francisca Monahan and Sarah Leeson. We had help today from Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director, Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening today, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.